So what? To have spoken of a new vision is to be asked in the next breath, what good will it do? When you come to think of it, this is astonishing, but it is invariably true in speaking with people brought up in the environment of Protestantism. Catholics, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, and Taoists understand that vision or contemplation is good in itself, even the supreme good, in the sense of the beatific vision, where all beings are eternally absorbed in the knowledge and love of God. But this possibility makes Protestants nervous. The reason is, I suppose, that modern Protestantism, particularly in its liberal and progressive forms, is the religion most strongly influenced by the mythology of the world of objects and of man as the separate ego. Humanity, so defined and so experienced, is, of course, incapable of pleasure and contentment, let alone creative power. The separate person is without content in both senses of the word. He lives perpetually on hope, on looking forward to tomorrow, having been brought up this way from childhood. If you want to find a true folk religion in our culture, look at the rites of Santa Claus. Even before the beginning of Advent, which was supposed to be a 3 to 4 week fasting period in preparation for the feast, the trees are decorated for Christmas, the shops glitter with tinsel and festive displays of gifts, and public address systems warble electronic carols so that one is sick to death of Venite Adoremus long before Christmas Day. Trees are already baubled and illumined in most homes, and as the big build-up proceeds, they are surrounded by those shiny packages with shimmering ribbons which look as if they held gifts for princes. By this time, Christmas parties have already been held in schools and offices before closing for the actual holiday, so that by Christmas Eve, the celebrations have just about blown their top. But there are still those packages under the tree and stockings by the fireplace. When at last the day comes, the children are frantic. Hardly able to wait for breakfast, and not having slept most of the night, they tear those gold and silver parcels to shreds as if they contained nothing less than the elixir of life or the philosopher's stone. By noon, the living room looks as if a waste paper truck had crashed into a dime store, leaving a wreck of mangled cartons, Excelsior wrapping paper, and writhing ribbons. Neckties, upended dolls, half-assembled model railroads, space suits, plastic atom bombs, and scattered chocolate bars, hundreds of tinker toy pieces, crushed tree ornaments, miniature sports cars, water pistols, bottles of whiskey, and balloons. An hour later, the children are blubbering or screaming and have to be shooed out of doors while the mess is shoved together to make room for Christmas dinner. Thereafter, the 12 days of Christmas are spent with upset stomachs, colds, and influenza, and on New Year's Eve, the adults get stoned to forget the whole thing. Well, it was fun describing it, but the point is that intense expectation fizzled. Expectation is kindled again to keep us all going for that golden, galumphious goodie at the end of the line. What could it be? The children knew it well until they got caught in the rat race. One of the best Christmas presents I ever had was a cheap ring with a glass diamond. It was quite incidental, something that came out of a cracker box at a party. But I sat down in front of the fireplace with this enchanted object and turned it to catch the different colors of light which blazed inside it. I was in touch with the timeless paradise world. Children are in touch with paradise to the extent that they have not fully learned the ego trick. And the same is true of cultures which, by our standards, are more primitive and, by analogy, childlike. If then, after understanding, at least in theory, that the ego trick is a hoax and that beneath everything, I and universe are one, you ask, so what? What is the next step, the practical application? I will answer that the absolutely vital thing is to consolidate your understanding, to become capable of enjoyment, of living in the present, and of the discipline which this involves. But the way is not back to some supposedly simpler time. Just as science overcame its purely atomistic and mechanical view of the world through more science, the ego trick must be overcome through intensified self-consciousness. For there is no way of getting rid of the feeling of separateness by a so-called act of will, by trying to forget yourself, or by getting absorbed in some other interest. This is why moralistic preaching is such a failure. It breeds only cunning hypocrites. Saints have always declared themselves as abject sinners through recognition that their aspiration to be saintly is motivated by the worst of all sins, spiritual pride, the desire to admire oneself as supreme success in the art of love and unselfishness. The ego trick seems to reaffirm itself endlessly in posture after posture. But as I pursue these games, as I become more conscious of being conscious, more aware that I am unable to define myself as being up without you or something other than myself being down, I see vividly that I depend on your being down for my being up. I would never be able to know that I belong to the in-group of nice or saved people without the assistance of an outside group of nasty or damned people. All winners need losers. All saints need sinners. All sages need fools. That is, so long as the major kick in life is to amount to something or to be someone as a particular separate godlet. But the question is how to get over the sensation of being locked out from everything other, of being only oneself, an organism flung into unavoidable competition and conflict with almost every object in its experience. There are innumerable recipes for this project, almost all of which have something to recommend them. There are the practices of yoga meditation, dervish dancing, psychotherapy, Zen Buddhism, Ignatian, Silesian, and other methods of prayer, the use of consciousness-changing chemicals such as LSD and mescaline, psychodrama, group dynamics, sensory awareness techniques, Quakerism, Gurdjieff exercises, relaxation therapies, the Alexander method, autogenic training, and self-hypnosis. The difficulty is that the more you strive for some kind of perfection or mastery in morals, in art, or in spirituality, the more you see that you are playing a rarefied and lofty form of the old ego game, and that your attainment of any height is apparent to yourself and to others only by contrast with someone else's depth of failure. This understanding is at first paralyzing. You are in a trap, in the worst of all double binds, seeing that any direction you may take will imply and so evoke its opposite. Decide to be a Christ, and there will be a Judas to betray you and a mob to crucify you. Decide to be a devil, and men will unite against you in the closest brotherly love. Your first reaction may be simply, to hell with it. The only course may seem to be to forget the whole effort and become absorbed in trivialities, or to check out of the game by suicide or psychosis and spend the rest of your days babbling in an asylum. But there is another possibility.
Now, therefore, when you come to the point when you understand that your idea of yourself is a delusion married to a futility, there is nothing you can do about the one thing that has to be done, which is to be different. There's nothing you can do about it. You realize that. Then what happens? What follows? The only thing that can follow is that you, as we say, observe what is going on. You cannot reject life. You cannot accept it. It simply has to happen. And it happens. It keeps going on. There is this vibration and that vibration, this thought, this feeling, this sensation, chitter, 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 commentary going on, it all out of the memory banks, all that happened. And all you can do is watch it. Can't change it, because there's no separate you standing outside it to change it. What is happening is you. And you say, I don't know about this. Who's in charge around here? Well, nobody is in charge. Nobody ever was in charge. Because the nature of energy is such that it doesn't need anyone to govern it. It doesn't have to have something separate from itself to make it do what it does.
When you know for sure that your separate ego is a fiction, you actually feel yourself as the whole person, process, and pattern of life. Experience and experiencer become one experiencing, known and knower. One knowing. Remember above all that an experience of this kind cannot be forced or made to happen by any act of your fictitious will. except insofar as repeated efforts to be one up on the universe may eventually reveal their futility. Don't try to get rid of the ego sensation. Take it, so long as it lasts, as a feature or play of the total process, like a cloud or wave, or like feeling warm or cold, or anything else that happens of itself. Getting rid of one's ego is the last resort of invincible egoism. It simply confirms and strengthens the reality of the feeling. But when this feeling of separateness is approached and accepted like any other sensation, it evaporates like the mirage it is. If, then, you ask me how to get beyond the ego feeling, I shall ask you why you want to get there. If you give me an honest answer, which is that your ego will feel better in the higher spiritual status of self-transcendence, you will thus realize that you, as ego, are a fake. You will feel like an onion, skin after skin, subterfuge after subterfuge, is pulled off to reveal no kernel at the center. Which is the whole point, to find out that the ego is indeed a fake, a wall of defense around a wall of defense, around nothing. You can't even want to get rid of it, nor yet want to. Understand this, and you will see that the ego is exactly what it pretends it isn't. Far from being the free center of personality, it is an automatic mechanism implanted since childhood by social authority, with perhaps a touch of heredity thrown in. This may give you the temporary feeling of being a zombie or a puppet dancing irresponsibly on strings. What has happened is that the frustrated ego has withdrawn into its last stronghold of independence, retaining its identity as a mere watcher or sufferer of all that goes on. Here, it pities itself or consoles itself as a puppet of fate. But if this is seen as yet another subterfuge, we are close to the final showdown. A line of separation is now drawn between everything that happens to me, including my own feeling on the one side, and on the other, I myself as the conscious witness. Isn't it easy to see that this line is imaginary, and that it and the witness behind it are the same old faking process automatically learned in childhood? Yet, in this moment, when one seems about to become a really total zombie, the whole thing blows up. For there is no fate unless there is someone or something to be fated. There is no trap without someone to be caught. There is indeed no compulsion unless there is also freedom of choice. For the sensation of behaving involuntarily is known only by contrast with that of behaving voluntarily. Thus, when the line between myself and what happens to me is dissolved, and there is no stronghold left for an ego, even as a passive witness, I find myself not in a world, but as a world, which is neither compulsive nor capricious. What happens is neither automatic nor arbitrary, it simply happens, and all happenings are mutually interdependent in a way that seems unbelievably harmonious. When this new sensation of self arises, it is at once exhilarating and a little disconcerting. It is like the moment when you first got the knack of swimming or riding a bicycle. There is the feeling that you are not doing it yourself, but that it is somehow happening on its own, and you wonder whether you will lose it, as indeed you may if you try forcibly to hold on to it. In immediate contrast to the old feeling, there is indeed a certain passivity to the sensation, as if you were a leaf blown along by the wind, until you realize that you are both the leaf and the wind. The world outside your skin is just as much you as the world inside. They move together inseparably. And at first you feel a little out of control, because the world outside is so much vaster than the world inside. Yet you soon discover that you are able to go ahead with ordinary activities, to work and make decisions as before, though somehow this is less of a drag. Your body is no longer a corpse which the ego has to animate and lug around. There is a feeling of the ground holding you up, and of hills lifting you when you climb them. Air breathes itself in and out of your lungs, and instead of looking and listening, light and sound come to you on their own. Eyes see and ears hear as wind blows and water flows. All space becomes your mind. Time carries you along like a river, but never flows out of the present. The more it goes, the more it stays, and you no longer have to fight or kill it. Once you have seen this, you can return to the world of practical affairs with a new spirit. You have seen that the universe is at root a magical illusion and a fabulous game, and that there is no separate you to get something out of it, as if life were a bank to be robbed. The only real you is the one that comes and goes, manifests and withdraws itself eternally in and as every conscious being. For you means the universe looking at itself from billions of points of view, points that come and go, so that the vision is forever new. Anyone who brags about knowing this doesn't understand it, for he is only using the theory as a trick to maintain his illusion of separateness, a gimmick in a game of spiritual one-upmanship. Moreover, such bragging is deeply offensive to those who do not understand and who honestly believe themselves to be lonely, individual spirits in a desperate and agonizing struggle for life. For all such, there must be deep and unpatronizing compassion, even a special kind of reverence and respect, because, after all, in them the self is playing its most far out and daring game, the game of having lost itself completely and of being in danger of some total and irremediable disaster. It comes then to this, that to be viable, livable, or merely practical, life must be lived as a game. And the must here expresses a condition, not a commandment. Life must be lived in the spirit of play rather than work, and the conflicts which it involves must be carried on in the realization that no species or party to a game can survive without its natural antagonists, its beloved enemies, its indispensable opponents. For to love your enemies is to love them as enemies. It is not necessarily a clever device for winning them over to your own side. As it is, we are merely bolting our lives, gulping down undigested experiences as fast as we can stuff them in, like frantic Christmas shoppers. Our awareness of our own existence is so superficial and so narrow that nothing seems to us more boring than simply being. If I ask you what you did, saw, heard, smelled, touched, and tasted yesterday, I'm likely to get nothing more than the thin, sketchy outline of the few things that you noticed, and of those, only what you thought worth remembering. Is it surprising that an existence experienced in this way seems so empty and bare that its hunger for an infinite future is insatiable? But suppose you could answer, it would take me forever to tell you, and I am much too interested in what's happening now. How is it possible that a being with such sensitive jewels as the eyes, such enchanted musical instruments as the ears, and such a fabulous arabesque of nerves as the brain can experience itself as anything less than God? And when you consider that this incalculably subtle organism is inseparable from the still more marvelous patterns of its environment, from the minutest electrical designs to the whole company of the galaxies, how is it conceivable that this incarnation of all eternity can be bored with being?